It was an inn of sorts. The three witches had never seen such a cheerless place in their lives, but it was quite crowded. A score or more pale-faced people watched them solemnly from benches around the walls. Nanny Ogg sniffed. "Caw," she said, "talk about garlic." And indeed bunches of it hung from every beam. "You can't have too much garlic, I always say. I can see I'm going to like it here." She nodded to a white-faced man behind the bar. "Good and day, big fella, mine host. Trois beers, pour favor, avec us. Silver plate."
"What's a silver plate got to do with it?" demanded Granny.
"It's foreign for please," said Nanny.
"I bet it isn't really," said Granny. "You're just making it up as you goes along."
The innkeeper, who worked on the fairly simple principle that anyone walking through the door wanted something to drink, drew three beers.
"See?"
said Nanny, triumphantly.
"I don't like the way everyone's looking at us," said Magrat, as Nanny babbled on to the perplexed man in her very own Esperanto. "A man over there grinned at me."
Granny Weatherwax sat down on a bench, endeavouring to position herself so that as small an amount of her body as possible was in contact with the wood, in case being foreign was something you could catch.
"There," said Nanny, bustling up with a tray. "Nothing to it. I just cussed at him until he understood."
"It looks horrible," said Granny.
"Garlic sausage and garlic bread," said Nanny. "My favourite."
"You ought to have got some fresh vegetables," said Magrat, the dietitian.
"I did. There's some garlic," said Nanny happily, cutting a generous slice of eye-watering sausage. "And I think I definitely saw something like pickled onions on one of the shelves."
"Yes, then we're going to need at least two rooms for tonight," said Granny sternly.
"Three," said Magrat very quickly.
She risked another look around the room. The silent villagers were staring at them intently with a look she could only describe to herself as a sort of hopeful sadness. Of course, anyone who spent much time in the company of Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg got used to being stared at. They were the kind of people that filled every space from edge to edge, and probably people in these parts didn't often see strangers, what with the thick forest and all. And the sight of Nanny Ogg eating a sausage with extreme gusto would even outrank her pickled onion number as a major entertainment anywhere. Even so, the way people were staring. Outside, deep in the trees, a wolf howled. The assembled villagers shivered in unison, as though they'd been practising. The landlord muttered something to them. They got up reluctantly and filed out of the door, trying to keep together. An old lady laid her hand on Magrat's shoulder for a moment, shook her head sadly, sighed, and then scuttled away. But Magrat was used to this, too. People often felt sorry for her when they saw her in Granny's company. Eventually, the landlord lurched across to them with a lighted torch and motioned them to follow him.
"How did you make him understand about the beds?" said Magrat.
"I said, 'Hey, Mr. Jig-Jag, toot sweet, all same, number three,'" said Nanny Ogg. Granny Weatherwax tried this under her breath and nodded. "Your lad Shane certainly gets around a bit, doesn't he?" she remarked.
"He says it works every time," said Nanny Ogg.
In fact, there were only two rooms up a long, winding and creaky stairway, and Magrat got one to herself. Even the landlord seemed to want it that way. He'd been very attentive. She wished he hadn't been so keen to bar the shutters, though. Magrat liked to sleep with the window open. As it was too dark and stuffy. Anyway, she thought, "I am the fairy godmother. The others are just accompanying me." She peered hopelessly at herself in the room's tiny cracked mirror, and then lay and listened to them on the far side of the paper-thin wall.
"What are you turning the mirror to the wall for, Esme?"
"I just don't like them staring like that."
"They only stares if you're staring at them, Esme."
Silence, and then,
"Hey, what's this round thing for, then?"
"I reckon it's supposed to be a pillow, Esme."
"Eh, I don't call it a pillow. And there's no proper blankets, even. What'd you say this thing's called?"
"I think it's called a duvet, Esme.
We call them an eiderdown where I come from. Heh."
There was a respite, then,
"Have you brushed your tooth?"
And another pause, then,
"Ooh, you haven't half got cold feet, Esme."
"No, they ain't. They're lovely and snug."
And another silence, then,
"Boots.
your boots. You've got your boots on.
I should just think I have got my boots on, Gither Og.
And your clothes. You haven't even undressed.
You can't be too careful in foreign parts. There could be all sorts out there, a-creeping around.
Magrat snuggled under the, what was it, duvet, and turned over. Granny Weatherwax appeared to need 1 hour's sleep a night, whereas Nanny Og would snore on a fence rail.
Gither! Gither! Gither!
What?
Are you awake?
Am now.
I keep hearing a noise.
So do I.
Magrat dozed for a while.
Gither! Gither!
What now?
I'm sure someone rattled on our shutters.
Not at our time of life. Now, get back to sleep.
The air in the room was getting hotter and stuffier by the minute. Magrat got out of bed, unbolted the shutters and flung them back dramatically. There was a grunt and a distant thud of something hitting the ground. The full moon streamed in. She felt a lot better for that and got back into bed. It seemed no time at all before the voice from next door woke her again.
Gither Og, what are you doing?
I'm having a snack.
Can't you sleep?
Just can't seem to be able to get off, Esme, said Nanny Og. Can't imagine why.
Yeah, that's garlic sausage you're eating. I'm actually sharing a bed with someone eating garlic sausage.
Hey, that's mine. Give it back.
Magrat was aware of booted footsteps in the pit of the night and the sound of a shutter being swung back in the next room. She thought she'd heard a faint oof and another muted thud.
I thought you liked garlic, Esme, said Nanny Og's resentful voice.
Sausage is all right in its place and its place ain't in bed. And don't you say a word now. Move over. You keep taking all the duvet.
After a while, the velvet silence was broken by Granny's deep and resonant snore. Shortly afterwards, it was joined by the genteel snoring of Nanny, who had spent far more time sleeping in company than Granny, and had evolved a more accommodating nasal orchestra. Granny's snore would have cut logs. Magrat folded the horrible round hard pillow over her ears and burrowed under the bedclothes. Somewhere on the chilly ground, a very large bat was trying to get airborne again. It had already been stunned twice, once by a carelessly opened shutter and once by a ballistic garlic sausage, and wasn't feeling very well at all. One more setback, it was thinking, and it's back off to the castle. Besides, it'd be sunrise soon. Its red eyes glinted as it looked up at Magrat's open window. It tensed. A paw landed on it. The bat looked around. Grebo had not had a very good night. He had investigated the whole place with regard to female cats and found none. He had prowled among the middens and drawn a blank. People in this town didn't throw garbage away. They ate it. He'd trotted into the woods and found some wolves and had sat and grinned at them until they got uncomfortable and went away. Yes, it had been a very uneventful night. Until now. The bat squirmed under his claw. It seemed to Grebo's small cat brain that it was trying to change its shape, and he wasn't having any of that from a mouse with wings on. Especially now, when he had someone to play with. Genua was a fairy tale city. People smiled and were joyful the livelong day, especially if they wanted to see another livelong day. Lilith made certain of that. Of course, people had probably thought they were happy in the days before she'd seen to it that the Duke replaced the old Baron, but it was a random, untidy happiness, which was why it was so easy for her to move in. But it wasn't a way of life. There was no pattern to it. One day they'd thank her. Of course, there were always a few difficult ones. Sometimes people just don't know how to act. You did your best for them. You ruled their city properly. You ensured that their lives were worthwhile and full of happiness every hour of the day. And then for no reason at all, they turned on you. Guards lined the audience chamber. And there was an audience. Technically, of course, it was the ruler who gave the audience. But Lilith liked to see people watching. One penny worth of example was worth a pound of punishment. There wasn't a lot of crime in Genua these days, at least not what would be considered crime elsewhere. Things like theft were easily dealt with and hardly required any kind of judicial process. Far more important, in Lilith's book, were crimes against narrative expectation. People didn't seem to know how they should behave. Lilith held a mirror up to life and chopped all the bits off life that didn't fit. The Duke lounged bonelessly on his throne, one leg dangling over the armrest. He'd never got the hang of chairs.
"And what has this one done?"
he said, and yawned. Opening his mouth wide was something he was good at least. A little old man cowered between two guards. There's always someone willing to be a guard, even in places like Genua. Besides, you got a really smart uniform with blue trousers and a red coat and a high black hat with a cockade in it.
But I can't whistle,
quavered the old man.
I didn't know it was compulsory.
But you are a toy maker, said the Duke. Toy makers whistle and sing the whole day long.
He glanced at Lilith. She nodded.
I don't know any songs, said the toy maker. I never got taught songs, just how to make toys. I was apprenticed at making toys 7 years before the little hammer, man and boy.
It says here,
said the Duke, making a creditable impersonation of someone reading the charge sheet in front of him,
that you don't tell the children stories.
No one ever told me about telling stories,
said the toy maker.
Look, I just make toys. Toys. That's all I'm good at, toys. I make good toys. I'm just a toy maker. You can't be a good toy maker if you don't tell stories to the children,
said Lilith, leaning forward. The toy maker looked up at the veiled face.
Don't know any,
he said.
You don't know any? I could tell 'em how to make toys,
the old man quavered. Lilith sat back. It was impossible to see her expression under the veil.
I think it would be a good idea if the people's guards here took you away, she said, to a place where you will certainly learn to sing, and possibly after a while you might even whistle. Won't that be nice?
The old baron's dungeons had been disgusting. Lilith had had them repainted and refurnished, with a lot of mirrors. When the audience was over, one member of the crowd slipped out through the palace kitchens. The guards on the side gate didn't try to stop her. She was a very important person in the small compass of their lives. Hello, Mrs. Pleasant. She stopped, reached into her basket, and produced a couple of roast chicken legs.
Just trying a new peanut coating, she said. Would value your opinion, boys.
They took them gratefully. Everyone liked to see Mrs. Pleasant. She could do things with a chicken that would almost make it glad it had been killed.
And now I'm just going out to get some herbs, she said.
They watched her as she went like a fat, determined arrow in the direction of the marketplace, which was right on the edge of the river. Then they ate the chicken legs. Mrs. Pleasant bustled along the market stalls, and she took great care to bustle. Even in Genua, there were always people ready to tell a tale, especially in Genua. She was a cook, so she bustled, and made sure she stayed fat and was, fortunately, naturally jolly. She made sure she had flowery arms at all times. If she felt under suspicion, she'd say things like, "Lorks!" She seemed to be getting away with it so far. She looked for the sign, and there it was. Perched up on the roof pole of a stall that was otherwise stacked with cages of hens, gazoots, wheelie cranes, and other fowl, was a black cockerel. The voodoo doctor was in. Even as her eye found it, the cockerel's head turned to look at her. Set a little way back from the rest of the stalls was a small tent, similar to many around the market. A cauldron bubbled in front of it on a charcoal fire. There were bowls beside it and a ladle, and beside them a plate with coins on it. There were quite a lot of coins. People paid for Mrs. Goggle's cooking, whatever they thought it was worth, and the plate was hardly big enough. The thick liquid in the cauldron was an unappetizing brown. Mrs. Pleasant helped herself to a bowlful and waited. Mrs. Goggle had certain talents. After a while, a voice from the tent said,
"What's new, Mrs. Pleasant?"
"She shut up the toy maker,"
said Mrs. Pleasant, to the air in general.
"And yesterday it was old Devereux, the innkeeper, for not being fat and not having a big red face. That's four times this month."
"You come in, Mrs. Pleasant."
It was dark and hot inside the tent. There was another fire in there, and another pot. Mrs. Gogol was hunched over it, stirring. She motioned the cook to a pair of bellows.
"Blow up the coals a tad, and we'll see what's what," she said.
Mrs. Pleasant obeyed. She didn't use magic herself, other than that necessary to get a roux to turn, or bread to rise, but she respected it in others, especially in the likes of Mrs. Gogol. The charcoal blazed white. The thick liquid in the pot began to churn. Mrs. Gogol peered into the steam.
"What are you doing, Mrs. Gogol?" said the cook anxiously.
"Trying to see what's going to happen," said the voodoo woman.
The voice dropped into the rolling growl of the psychically gifted. Mrs. Pleasant squinted into the roiling mass.
"Someone's going to be eating shrimp," she said helpfully.
"You see that bit of okra?" said Mrs. Gogol. "You see the way the crab legs keep coming up just there?"
"You never were one to stint the crab meat," said Mrs. Pleasant.
"See the way the bubbles is so thick by the oku leaves? See the way it all spirals around that purple onion?"
"I see it, I see it," said Mrs. Pleasant.
"And you know what that means?"
"Means it's going to taste real fine."
"Sure," said Mrs. Gogol kindly, "and it means some people's coming."
"Wow, how many?"
Mrs. Gogol dipped a spoon into the seething mass and tasted it.
"Three people," she said. She smacked her lips thoughtfully. "Women."
She dipped the spoon again.
"Have a taste," she said. "There's a cat, too. Ye can tell by the sassafras."
She smacked her lips.
"Grey. One eye."
She explored the cavity of a tooth with her tongue.
"The left one."
Mrs. Pleasant's jaw dropped.
"They'll find you before they find me," said Mrs. Gogol. "You lead them here."
Mrs. Pleasant stared at Mrs. Gogol's grim smile and then back down at the mixture in the pot.
"They're coming all this way for a taste," she said.
"Sure,"
Mrs. Gogol sat back. "You mean to see the girl in the White House?" Mrs. Pleasant nodded.
"Young Embers," she said. "Yeah, when I can, when the sisters are out at the palace." "They got her real scared, Mrs. Gogol."
She looks down at the pot again and back up to Mrs. Gogol.
"Can you really see?"
"I expect you've got things to marinate,"
said Mrs. Gogol.
"Yeah, yeah."
Mrs. Pleasant backed out, but with reluctance. Then she halted. Mrs. Pleasant, at rest, was not easily moved again until she wanted to be.
"That Lilith woman says she can see the whole world in mirrors,"
she said, in slightly accusing tones. Mrs. Gogol shook her head.
"All anyone gets in a mirror is themselves," she said, "but what you get in a good gumbo is everything."
Mrs. Pleasant nodded. This was a well-known fact. She couldn't dispute it. Mrs. Gogol shook her head sadly when the cook had gone. A voodoo woman was reduced to all sorts of stratagems in order to appear knowing, but she felt slightly ashamed of letting an honest woman believe that she could see the future in a pot of gumbo. Because all you could see in a pot of Mrs. Gogol's gumbo was that the future certainly contained a very good meal. She'd really seen it in a bowl of jambalaya she'd prepared earlier. Magrat lay with the wand under her pillow. She wobbled gently between sleep and wakefulness. Certainly she was the best person for the wand. There was no doubt about that. Sometimes, and she hardly dared give the thought headroom when she was under the same roof as Granny Weatherwax, she really wondered about the other's commitment to witchcraft. Half the time, they didn't seem to bother. Take medicine, for an example. Magrat knew she was much better than them at herbs. She'd inherited several large books on the subject from Goody Wemper, her predecessor in the cottage, and had essayed a few tentative notes of her own as well. She could tell people things about the uses of devil's bit scabious that would interest them so much they'd rush off, presumably, to look for someone else to tell. She could fractionally distill and double distill and do things that meant sitting up all night watching the colour of the flame under the retort. She worked at it. Whereas Nanny just tended to put a hot poultice on everything and recommend a large glass of whatever the patient liked best on the basis that since you were going to be ill anyway, you might as well get some enjoyment out of it. Magrat forbade her patients alcohol because of what it did to the liver. If they didn't know what it did to the liver, she spent some time telling them. And Granny, she just gave people a bottle of coloured water and told them they felt a lot better. And what was so annoying was that they often did. Where was the witchcraft in that? With a wand, though, things could be different. You could help people a lot with a wand. Magic was there to make life better. Magrat knew this in the pink fluttering boudoir of her heart. She dipped under the surface of sleep again. And there was an odd dream. She never mentioned it to anyone afterwards because, well, you didn't. Not things like that. But she thought she'd got up in the night, awakened by the silence, to get some more air. And as she passed the mirror, she saw a movement in it. It wasn't her face. It looked a lot like Granny Weatherwax. It smiled at her, a much nicer and friendlier smile than she'd ever got from Granny, Magrat recalled, and then vanished, the cloudy silver surface closing over it. She hurried back to bed and awoke to the sound of a brass band engaged in unrelenting oompa. People were shouting and laughing. Magrat got dressed quickly, went out into the corridor, and knocked on the door of the older witch's. There was no reply. She tried the handle. After she'd rattled it a couple of times, there was a thump, as the chair wedged under the handle on the other side, the better to deter ravishers, burglars, and other nocturnal intruders, fell over. Granny Weatherwax's boots protruded from under the covers at one end of the bed. Nanny Ogg's bare feet, Nanny being something of a nighttime revolver, were beside them. Faint snores rattled the jug on the washbasin. These were no longer the full-nosed roars of a quick 40 winks catnapper, but the well-paced growls of someone who intends to make a night of it. Magrat knocked on the sole of Granny's boot. "Hey, wake up! Something's going on!" Granny Weatherwax waking up was quite an impressive sight, and one not seen by many people. Most people on waking up accelerate through a quick, panicky, pre-conscious check-up. Who am I? Where am I? Who is he? She? Good God, why am I cuddling a policeman's helmet? What happened last night? And this is because people are riddled by doubt. It is the engine that drives them through their lives. It is the elastic band in the little model aeroplane of their soul. And they spend their time winding it up until it knots. Early morning is the worst time. There's that little moment of panic in case you have drifted away in the night and something else has moved in. This never happened to Granny Weatherwax. She went straight from fast asleep to instant operation on all six cylinders. She never needed to find herself because she always knew who was doing the looking. She sniffed.
"Something's burning," she said.
"They've got a bonfire too," said Magrat.
Granny sniffed again.
"They're roasting garlic," she said.
"I know. I can't imagine why. They're ripping all the shutters off the windows and burning them in the square and dancing around the fire."
Granny Weatherwax gave Nanny Ogg a vicious jab with her elbow.
"Wake up, you." "I didn't get a wink of sleep all night," said Granny reproachfully. "What with her snoring."
Nanny Ogg raised the covers cautiously.
"It's far too early in the morning for it to be early in the morning," she said.
"Come on," said Granny. "We need your skill with languages."
The owner of the inn flapped his arms up and down and ran around in circles. Then he pointed at the castle that towered over the forest. Then he sucked vigorously at his wrist. Then he fell over on his back. And then he looked expectantly at Nanny Ogg, while behind him the bonfire of garlic and wooden stakes and heavy window shutters burned merrily.
"No," said Nanny after a while. "Still non comprendi, mein Herr."
The man got up and brushed some dust off his leather breeches.
"I think he's saying that someone's dead," said Magrat. "Someone in the castle."
"Well, I must say everyone seems very cheerful about it," said Granny Weatherwax severely.
In the sunlight of the new day, the village looked far more cheerful. Everyone kept nodding happily at the witches.
"That's because it was probably the landlord," said Nanny Ogg. "Bit of a bloodsucker, I think he's saying."
"Ah, that'll be it then."
Granny rubbed her hands together and looked approvingly at the breakfast table, which had been dragged out into the sunshine.
"Anyway, the food has certainly improved. Pass the bread, Magrat."
"Everyone keeps smiling and waving at us," said Magrat. "And look at all this food."
"That's only to be expected," said Granny with a mouthful. "They've only had us here one night and already they're learning it's lucky to be kind to witches. Now, help me get the lid off this honey."
Under the table, Gribo sat and washed himself. Occasionally he burped. Vampires have risen from the dead, the grave and the crypt, but have never managed it from the cat.
Dear Jason, and all at number 21, number 34, number 15, number 87 and number 61, but not at number 18 until she gives back the ball she definitely borrowed, whatever she says. Well, here we are. Cor, what a lark so far. Don't ask me about pumpkins. Still, no harm done. I'm drawing a picture of where we stayed last night. I have put an X on our room where our room is. The weather...
What are you doing, Gither? We're ready to leave.
Nanny Ogg looked up, her face still creased with the effort of composition. I thought it would be nice to send something to our Jason, you know, to stop him worrying. So I done a drawing of this place on a piece of card, and mine hair here will give it to someone going our way. You never know, it might get there. Continues fine. Nanny Ogg sucked the end of her pencil. Not for the first time in the history of the universe, someone for whom communication normally came as effortlessly as a dream was stuck for inspiration when faced with a few lines on the back of a card. Well, that about wraps it up for now. We'll write, crossed out, write again soon, Mum. P.S. The cat is looking very peaky. I think he misses his home.
Will you come on, Gither? Magrat's getting my broom started for me.
P.P.S. Granny sends her love. Nanny Ogg sat back, content in the knowledge of a job well done. Nanny Ogg sent a number of cards home to her family, not a single one of which got back before she did. This is traditional, and happens everywhere in the universe. Magrat reached the end of the town square and stopped to rest. Quite an audience had gathered to see a woman with legs. They were very polite about it. Somehow that made it worse. It doesn't fly unless you run really fast, she explained, aware even as she spoke how stupid this sounded, especially if you were listening in a foreign language. I think it's called hump starting. She took a deep breath, scowled in concentration, and ran forward again. This time it started. It jolted in her hands. The bristles rustled. She managed to slip it into neutral before it could drag her along the ground. One thing about Granny Weatherwax's broomstick, it was one of the very old-fashioned ones built in the days when broomsticks were built to last and not fall apart with woodworm after 10 years, was that while it might take some starting, when it went, it didn't hang about. Magrat had once considered explaining the symbolism of the witch's broomstick to Granny Weatherwax, and decided not to. It would have been worse than the row about the significance of the maypole. Departure took some time. The villagers insisted on giving them little gifts of food. Nanny Ogg made a speech which no one understood, but which was generally cheered. Gribo, hiccuping occasionally, oozed into his accustomed place among the bristles of Nanny's broomstick. As they rose above the forest, a thin plume of smoke also rose from the castle. And then there were flames.
"I see people dancing in front of it," said Magrat.
"Always a dangerous business renting property," said Granny Weatherwax. "I expect he was a bit lax when it came to redecorating and repairing the roof and such like. People take against that kind of thing. My landlord hasn't done a hand's turn on my cottage the whole time I've been there," she added. "It's shameful. And me an old woman, too."
"I thought you owned your place," said Magrat, as the broomsticks set off over the forest.
"She just ain't paid no rent for 60 years," said Nanny Ogg.
"Is that my fault?" said Granny Weatherwax. "It's not my fault. I'd be quite willing to pay." She smiled a slow, self-confident smile. "All he has to do is ask," she added,